Well, it's time again for the Pilgrim on the 405, the only show that wanders the world in search of the latest techniques and technologies to make you a success in the new world of sales. It starts right now with your own personal guide through this strange new wilderness, sales trainer extraordinaire, Will Crist.
Well, welcome to the Pilgrim Talks on this day when it is cooling off. After having record-breaking heat wave, we're getting cooler now. At least we are in Laguna Beach, so I'm giving thanks for that. I am always surprised. I never know quite what I'm going to find when I visit with business owners, CEOs of companies, C-level people. I never know, and I'm always surprised at the creativity that I find in Orange County. Now, I suppose that other places in the country would believe they find similar creativity, but I think we have an edge on that. You have economic downturns. We've talked about in the past the variety of ways that creative CEOs approach the problems associated with economic downturn or a change in the marketplace. Obviously, they have to increase their revenue. They pay a lot of attention to reducing costs, reducing expenses. They're always looking at how to retain current clients and how to improve, develop, train, support their distribution scheme, their partners, and their employees. Orange County has a wonderful base of creative, entrepreneurial, inventive type of people. We often hear of those garage inventors around MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or in Silicon Valley, Steve Jobs and his buddies. We heard of Hewlett-Packard starting off very small. It's really interesting to find those people in Orange County. We've spoken to inventors who, with teams of engineers, have put together a way that's going to revolutionize the way the cell phones are charged at Suncor with Steve Brimmer. We've talked to people who have been in the process of changing their product offerings, their service offerings, to meet the needs of their customers. It's not often that we have the opportunity to talk to somebody who actually began in a garage with an invention that is revolutionizing his particular industry. So when I had the opportunity to meet with Steve Pixley at AutoCrib, I was very eager to hear about how he got started and what that meant to be in the garage, all of those inventions, pieces are put together. So I'm looking forward to spending time, and I was so fascinated with Steve's story that I asked him to be on the take the entire show today so we can explore not only how he got to where he is today, but what he's doing to expand in the future. So, Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Will. Appreciate you having me.
Well, it's really fascinating. I mean, I want you to tell us a little bit about what AutoCrib is, and then I want to hear. I want our listeners to hear about your garage experience and how all this came to be. So, tell us about what AutoCrib does, so we have some context.
Okay. Well, AutoCrib is in the business of building technology specifically for dispensing products in large factories, machine shops, metalworking companies, woodworking companies, anybody that really consumes an expendable item, and that can be anything from a glove to a drill bit, a tap, or even a large hammer, screwdriver, things of that nature. So what we really do is control the indirect inventory in manufacturing facilities. And we do that with vending technology. Now, these would not be typical vending machines that you would normally associate the vending world with, machines that dispense Coke or candy. They tend to be more robotic carousels and machines of that nature.
All right, so we have a vending machine that dispenses tools or other items.
Correct.
And I'm presuming people don't come up and deposit a pocket full of change to get a tool.
No, we don't take money. We take information. So the employee walks up to the machine, enters in his employee number, and he can do that in a variety of ways. It can be something as simple as him just typing in his employee number, or it can be something as sophisticated as a fingerprint scanner or a hand punch or even an iris scanner. So it really depends on what the company uses as their system for identifying employees. At that point, he would type a PIN number in, not unlike what you would do at a ATM machine or at a credit card machine. Then you would answer some questions about why you were taking that specific tool or item, such as what department are you from or what job are you working on. And then the machine would communicate back to a central server somewhere and ask the central server to validate the information that he's given the machine and make decisions on whether or not he's allowed to have that tool or item. And if he is, the server gives a signal back to the vending machine saying, go ahead and dispense that item. So it's not just a dispensation system, but it's also an access control system and an inventory control system.
So tell me a little bit more about inventory control.
Okay. Really, that is the heart of the system. What we're trying to do for these companies is reduce their spend, but also reduce their carrying costs because, as you can imagine, we're dispensing items that are many times more expensive and more valuable in the manufacturing world than you would with a candy bar or a Coke or something along those lines. So they really are driven to reduce the total spend and the total inventory that's being contained in these machines or in their system, if you will. So what we do is we use something as simple as a min-max or a reorder point, reorder quantity model, or we can use demand compression and very advanced inventory algorithms to really drive that inventory level down in these plants and help the customer with reducing his total overhead and load that it takes to run the plant.
So typically in plants like this, there is a tool crib, and there may be several of them around if it's a large plant. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And in that tool crib will be some people who are there to manage the inventory and dispense those tools.
Right.
Then I presume the employee would walk across the plant to that tool dispensing crib, take the tool, and take it back to where he's working on it, right?
Right. Check out the tool, and off he goes back to his work center. That's another area where dispensing machines, industrial vending machines, can help a client, which is to reduce what we call walking around time. That's the time spent moving from your work center to the crib and back, because invariably what happens is you talk to your buddy about what was on Monday Night Football, you stop and get a Coke at the vending machine, you go to the bathroom, and all of that is lost productivity for the manufacturing facility. So one of the driving forces on top of, you know, obviously access control on who's getting the tools and what are they using it for, and the inventory control piece is also let's keep the worker at his work center. That's where the productivity happens. That's where the efficiency happens. So these are all reasons that people purchase industrial vending machines. And in the economic downturn, we've also had a new phenomenon happening with industrial vending machines, which is we need to reduce the number of heads related to the indirect spend of our company. So we have, you know, older people in tool cribs that are retiring, and the company doesn't want to replace that person so they can get a savings there. So they're using RFID portal and, you know, industrial vending machines to be able to provide a 24/7 access to the product at a much lower cost than actually putting a human being in there.
All right, so before we get any further, I got several other questions I want to ask you about this, but tell us a little bit about how this all happened. I mean, I'm just fascinated with this whole idea of building this in the garage while you were you had a full-time job.
That's right. Yeah, and A lot of people thought I was crazy at the time and probably still do. One of those people would be my wife. The way I got into this business, I had a computer science background, classically trained as a programmer, worked for NCR and IBM for a number of years, and worked specifically in the manufacturing industry. So I had always had some background in manufacturing plants. Back in the early to mid 80s, a friend of mine, actually one of my fraternity brothers in college, was working for Ford Aerospace in Newport Beach, and during that period of time, they had developed a military tank that was specifically designed to shoot down Russian helicopters. Well, from the time that they built the prototype till the time that they actually started fielding the tank, Russian helicopter technology had improved to the point where it could kill the tank much faster and better than the tank could kill the helicopter. So the tank was obsolete on day one. And my buddy was assigned to sell off all of the tools that they needed to make those tanks. And that's really where we got started. So at that time, I was working at the Chevy S10 factory in Dayton, Ohio, and he asked me if my plant manager would be interested in buying some of these tools, and we checked that out with him, and in fact he was, and we came up with a scheme to sell Chevy Ford Aerospace's tools. We would buy them and then resell them, and we would make a couple $1 million, and then we would buy a yacht and sail around in the Caribbean for a couple of years, and then come back and get real jobs. So that was the business plan.
Yes.
That didn't really work out so great, and we kind of evolved into selling tools on the back of a pickup truck, and that turned into an industrial distributorship that was specifically focused on selling cutting tools in the Southern California market. And over the years, the company grew and became a real business, real distribution business. And at that point in time, I got the idea. I was out selling tools every day. And I would visit my customers, and they'd say, "Hey, Steve, you know, we need you to go pick up 100 more of this or 50 more of that." And I would say, "That's impossible. We delivered 50 here yesterday. There's no possible way you could have consumed that many drills or inserts or whatever that customer was using." And they'd say, "Well, we can't find them, so go get me some more." So after
can't
hearing
find
that,
them?
For,
say again, 50 of them. They would lose.
Yeah,
50 of them
they would
in a
lose
day.
Them. They would break them. They would, in some cases, use them. But for the most part, in the tool world, we count on our customers. For every one that they need or they actually use, they buy three: one to use, one to break, and one to lose. And that's been a common, whatever you want to call it, saying in our industry for many, many years. And I came to the realization that I couldn't do anything about the one they use, I couldn't do anything about the one they break, but maybe I could help them with the one that they lose. And that was the impetus of the whole vending system. And what I would, at that point in time, I was the president of the distribution business, and I would work in my garages and at night and on weekends trying to hook a vending machine up to a computer. And in those days, the computers were relatively crude. We're talking about in the early 90s at this point in time, the PCs, and vending machines were even dumber. So it was a challenging electronics project to hook the two machines together and get them to communicate. And we basically bought a off-the-shelf candy machine and an off-the-shelf IBM PC and went to work trying to design a board that would allow the two machines to communicate. And it took us, a friend of mine and I worked in my garage nights and weekends, took us about a year to actually break the code and get the two machines to talk to each other. So that's really where the whole idea around vending came from.
So then your job was to go out and to sell the vending machines to manufacturing plants, right?
That was the idea. Yeah, that was the idea. And we
from the back of a truck, right?
Well, from the back of a truck or from the car, or any way you could get it done, right? We had spent a lot of time and money building this tool vending machine, and we needed to recover some of that time and money in the form of sales. So off we went to sell the vending machines, and lo and behold, nobody wanted to buy one.
No.
So that was discouraging, and we worked at that for quite some time. We had built an inventory package around inventory control software package around the vending machines, so they could in addition to actually using the vending machines, they could also run a traditional or a manual tool crib, if you will, with our software. And we worked very hard to go out there and sell some. And our first customer was Control Components down in Rancho Santa Margarita. But they didn't really want to buy them. They said, we just like to use them. And so it occurred to me that maybe we shouldn't be selling the vending machines. Maybe we should be giving them away in exchange for our competitors' business. And that is really what set vending going in about 95 or 96. We stopped trying to sell the machines, and we would go to our customers and we'd say, hey, you're doing $20,000 a month in tool business with our competitors. How about if we put in the vending system and we get you out of the tool management business and it doesn't cost you a penny? All you have to do is give me all my competitors' business or give me the majority of it. And really that is how we started changing the tool industry to the point where now if you don't have a vending line, you probably aren't going to be real successful as a tool distributor.
So you followed Gillette's model, right?
Gave away Coke's razors model,
and selling razor blades.
But, right, yeah, basically, yes.
All right, so that worked in Southern California for your tool business here.
Yes, it did. And we did it for a number of years, and the company grew very, very fast. We went from $6 million a year in sales to $30 million in sales in about 3 years, and it had taken us the better part of 10 years to go from zero to $6 million. So managing the growth became a very challenging thing for us. Because in the tool business, it's a low-margin business, so you really have to watch your cash flow. You can't really grow much beyond what your gross profit margins are per year, or you're upside down from a cash flow standpoint. So we realized, I mean, our initial plan was world domination of the tool market, and it was our intention to never, ever sell any vending machines, just to own all the vending machines and own all the tool business in the United States. And after a few years of that growth rate, we came to the realization that that we weren't going to be able to dominate the United States or the world or even California. We just didn't have the cash in order to pull that off. So at that point, we decided that maybe what we should do is spin the vending manufacturing part of the business off, and they would go out and sell the vending machines to other tool distributors around the country, but not set anybody up that would be a direct competitor to our sister company. Machine Tool Supply is the name of the tool company. So we have an agreement with them that we wouldn't set anybody up right around here, and that's how we endeavored to go ahead and recover all the R&D money and build a business around the vending machine line. So that today is what I do.
All right, so you still have the tool company that is selling tools through the vending machines that have been installed in Southern California.
Right.
And that business is going well.
Yes, that business is going well.
And so now you have begun to talk to other, or you have been for a while now, talking to other tool distributors to simply follow the same model that you followed with your tool company.
That's right. I got on the airplane and I started going around to tool companies all over the U.S. at first, and then started moving to Europe and other parts of the world, teaching them the model that we had developed here in Southern California. And in doing that, we started to sell vending machines to these distributors who would do the exact same thing that we did. They'd go to their customer base and say, how about you give me all the tools and I'll place in a auto crib vending system in your plant for free.
And how'd that work?
That worked. It was slow at first, but today we have 126 dealers around the world, and we build in excess of 500 machines a year that we sell to those 126 dealers.
And do you participate in the sale of those tools from those through those distributors?
No, no. That was something that that was a model that I tried to get going, but didn't have much success. Which is, how about I buy the vending machine, Mr. Tool Dealer in Cincinnati, Ohio, and you just give me a piece of all the sales that go through it. And unfortunately, they were smart enough to realize and run the numbers and determine that they would pay for the vending machine 10 times over a 5-year period had they done that. So that didn't really work out for me.
So the distributor buys – they actually give you a check for the vending machine.
Yeah, they either buy it, lease it, or rent it.
Oh, they could lease it from you.
Yes. Uh-huh. They could buy it, lease it, or rent it from us. We'll do any one of the three, and then they take that and they go build their businesses. And some of them have built very nice businesses around it.
And you can take that lease down to the at least you could. I don't know if you still can, but at one point you could take that lease down to the bank and you could get money on that for your capital needs, right?
Right. Yes.
Okay. So they're acquiring the vending machine, and then they're using that vending machine to take away business from their competitor. Right?
Yes, right, yes. We typically use this as an offensive weapon. So what we're trying to do is go and steal our competitor's business. You know, that's an important point here is that we're a business, the tool business is a business that is shrinking in size. Manufacturers are leaving the U.S., you know, at an increasing rate every single year, and so there's less and less business for the tool guys, tool dealers around the country every single year. So the only way you're going to grow your company is if you come up with some way in which to go out and take business away from your competitor. And that's what we offer is we offer them a weapon to go out and take the business from the competitors in the Cincinnati marketplace, for example. And we do that very, very effectively. And we're in an enviable position in that we get to be the kingmaker in many cases. And our strategy is we'll typically go after the number two player in the market. So I don't want to hook up with Hertz. I want to hook up with Avis. And the reason for that is because the Avis guy tends to be a little bit hungrier, and the Hertz guy looks at the Cincinnati market and says, well, I already have a 50 or 60 or 70% market share, so all this vending thing is going to do for me is reduce my sales, because typically vending machines will cut the consumption by 20% or so. And so if you have 70% of the market share, at the net effect, if we went to put vending machines in all of your customers, we're going to reduce your sales. So the number two guy that's sitting at 20% or 25%, he's looking at it and licking his chops and saying, wow, if I put these vending machines in, I could grow my business to 50% market share or something like that. So it's kind of a little bit different strategy than what typically you would do when you're lining yourself up with a distribution or a dealer network. Where you're trying to go get the big guy, we actually would prefer the little guy, or maybe the medium-sized guy.
Mm-hmm. And so you would then strategically approach a distributor in a marketplace like Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Philadelphia based upon their standing in the marketplace.
That's right, yes. We evaluate who the players are in the market. My sales force does. They go and talk to them. They find out how tech savvy they are, because we don't want to have to teach Windows and, you know, basic computer skills. We look at where they rank in the marketplace. We actually will go out and talk to some local customers, machine shops, you know, assembly plants, what have you. Find out who the players are and what they think of them. And then based on that, we make a decision on who we give the line to, who we give the AutoCrib line to.
All right. And so now are you aligned then? Are your interests aligned with that distributor?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, obviously, this is a challenge from our standpoint. The distributor wants to put in as little equipment as possible, or whatever is needed or necessary to secure the business. So we refer to that as slow roll in the customer. In other words, I'll go in, and the old Pareto rule applies to pretty much everything in life, and it certainly applies in tools. If you look at a machine shop or Ford Motor Company or Boeing Aerospace, whatever, 20% of the tools create 80% of the velocity and the value in the shop. So what I'm saying is 20, if you can lock up the fastest moving 20% of the tool base in that plant, you're going to get 80% of the customer's sales. So that's what we teach, and that's what our dealers do, is they'll go in and say, hey, if I can put five machines in and get the 20% of the tool base that makes up 80% of the sales here, then that's what I will do. And we're a little bit at odds with them in saying, hey, why don't you finish the job? Go put in another five machines and lock the customer up. So, but that costs money, and the return on the investment is lower, relatively low, compared to the first three or four machines that went in. You follow me?
So
that's other than that, I'd say that we're pretty well aligned with our dealer network.
With this dealer network, I understand that you're helping them to improve the quality of the sales process that their people are using, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have to. Yeah, and that,
tell me about that.
Well, this is something that we've struggled with for 10 years or so, which is the typical tool salesman is an older gentleman, probably got 20, 25 years of selling tools, and they typically use a process that I refer to as feature advantage benefit selling. And I didn't coin that term. I don't know who did, but that's what they do. They walk in and they say, let me show you, Mr. Customer, this new drill bit. And it's got this really cool delta tip on it that was developed by a wizard over in Japan. And if you use the drill, you're going to be able to increase your penetration rate into the material by X percent, and that's going to either save you time or save you money. It's going to put more parts on the floor. You're going to be able to get better utilization out of your machine tool or whatever their spiel is. You're using a feature advantage benefit approach to selling tools. That's not how you sell vending machines and systems. You need to use a much more sophisticated sales process where you actually try to inflict pain on the customer or show him where his pain is, and then once you've put a price on that pain, you sell it the medicine. And this is something that we have struggled with and came up with lots of ideas on how do we train the sales force out on the street, the actual guys that are in the manufacturing plants, and have had very limited success with them. But we continue to work at it and do better every day, but we could do a lot better if we could get these salesmen to change the way they sell.
All right, so you're saying that in effect, people have to move beyond this feature advantage benefit selling to much more of a collaborative solution, getting on the same side of the table, understanding the real business drivers, the real problems that manufacturer has.
Right, and start to add some value to the process. Instead of just being an order taker, going in there and saying, what are the things that you're struggling with? So, for instance, if you're a motorhome manufacturer, your plant is probably very long, and so you're going to have a long walk time from the central tool crib to the work centers that are on the end of the line, where they're putting the decals on the side of the motorhome. So what's important to a motorhome manufacturer or semi-trailer manufacturer is time or productivity. I don't care so much about who took what or how many flashlights we used or how many double D batteries we used this month. What I care about is that my welders have the stuff that they need and they're not spending 45 minutes walking back and forth to the tool crib five times a day. In a plant that you're making computer chassis, that's probably a very small plant where you're making BlackBerry frames or cases or things like that. The walking around time is not as important to them. What they care more about is productivity at the spindle where the tool's actually making the part. So for us, what we need to do is sit down with the customer and find out what are the cost drivers in their business and then show them how we can apply the strengths of our system to solve their problem. And that's a difficult thing to do, to teach an old tool salesman.
Well, I mean, I agree with you that that's the system that will help people to get clear about how they're help them to see their return on investment in terms of time, resources, and money. But you say that there's difficulty in training people. Can't you just tell them, just go out and do it? This is what to do. This is how you'll succeed, and expect them to do it.
Yeah, I wish it worked that way. It doesn't.
Yeah.
We do that. We've flown them into California. We run training classes every 6 weeks here, 3-day training classes. We've put together webinars. We've put together CDs. I think one of the most effective things that we did was we put together a series of sales training CDs and a web-based test so that the presidents of these distributorships could give the guys, their sales force, the CDs, and say, listen to them in the car when you're driving from account to account, and then at the end of the week or at the end of the month, I'm going to test you to see how much you've actually retained. And that, of all the things that we've done, that's probably been the most effective sales training tool, which is drill it into their head and make them pass a test on it. And if they don't pass the test, they got to go back and listen to the CDs again. But it's painful, and we get a lot of pushback from the sales people that actually have to listen to the CDs. They don't like that. But that's probably the most effective thing that we've done. So telling them once doesn't really work.
All right. Telling them once doesn't work. What do you sense has to be there for them to begin to implement these changes?
I think that where I think we have the best success in training our sales force, our collective sales force, if you will, is when we expose them to the material and then we drill, what I like to refer to as drill and kill. Expose it to them once and then just continue to drill them on it and drill them on it until they kill the material, until they got it down cold. And then at that point, you have to, now that it's been committed to both short-term and long-term memory, now you have to sit down with the salesman in a real-life situation with a customer and start to apply those principles. And when he goes askew and starts going back to feature advantage benefit selling, you have to step in at that point and say, Mr. Customer, tell me what your objective is here at the plant to reduce costs, for whatever you're trying to accomplish. You know, what's your objective to reduce the walking around time in the plant? What's your strategy to get to reduce consumption of cutting tools in this facility? And bring them back to the questioning process that allows us to show the value that we add. In other words, sell them the medicine. You know, they're telling us what the pain is. Now we got to sell them the medicine.
Well, are these salespeople? I mean, you're talking about a lot of salespeople, right? Did you say 120 distributors?
Well, but when you consider the dealer base, we're probably talking in the neighborhood of between 600 and 800 salespeople.
All right. So out of those 600, 800 salespeople, do they see any value in using this new way of selling? Any value for themselves? Do they have any? Is there any pain that they have right now?
The salesperson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, this is my impression, but you know, through the recession, their commissions have been reduced significantly. I mean, people are buying less tools. So if you're doing it the old-fashioned way of running around and trying to sell a drill bit today, or trying to sell a tap, or whatever you sell today, gloves, glasses, safety products, the business has been reduced over the past 2 years significantly. So maybe you were making $80,000 or $90,000 a year as the top tool guy in Cincinnati. Well, now you're making 50. So that's the pain, I think.
Okay. Could they get that back up if they were able to sell in this different way, this new way?
I would say I can't think of one tool salesman that I've converted to a system salesperson or a vending salesman that didn't make significantly more money under the new system than he did under the old system. Now it's work. It's not easy, but they always end up making more.
So moving from the features, advantages, and benefit system to the consultative, I don't want to say, you said inflicting pain, and then I think you said helping them to the buyer to discover the pain that's already there, right?
Right. That was a misstatement. I didn't mean inflicting pain. Showing them their pain. In other words, making them feel their pain.
Yeah, helping them to get beyond that, that river in Egypt, that denial.
Right.
I don't want to feel that pain because I wouldn't know what to do about it if I felt it.
Right, exactly.
So helping them get in touch with the pain. And then being willing to begin to share with them a potential solution that could take the pain away.
Exactly. That's the way to be successful.
Well, now, my question to you is, if that works with the manufacturers, would that work with the salespeople? If they could experience their pain and begin to recognize, get the sense that there are alternatives that, if adopted, granted it's not going to be easy, but if adopted and practiced faithfully, that there's a high probability that they could get rid of that pain and get a lot of that commission back. I'm wondering
I think you're absolutely right there. We could definitely use the same approach on the salesman. The problem, though, is with the manufacturer, you have a magic pill, and it costs this much, right? I mean, you sign the contract, and I deliver a system, and your pain goes away. It's a pretty simple thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the salesman, it's a little bit different deal. In other words, instead of giving them a magic pain, what I tell them is you need to go on a big diet and an exercise program. And that's where I think we fall apart. This is because you can't just take a pill. You actually have to change your habits in your life. And that's where the real problem for AutoCrib is that it's difficult to get people to break a bad habit.
Now, I've worked in the past with a number of companies, a major global lighting company that had to sell through distributors. Several other companies have had to sell through distributors rather than to sell to the end users. And in every case, what we had to do is because there was a huge number of salespeople in those distribution companies. And what we had to do was we had to identify, and it was really self-identification on the part of the salespeople. We had to come up with our dream team in that marketplace. And in order to qualify that for that dream team, people had to recognize, use your weight loss mentality or your health mentality. That in order to qualify, they had to, number one, they had to want to lose weight and get fit. Number two, they had to agree to learn how to lose weight and get fit. And then number three, they had to do the behaviors. And without that, they weren't on the dream team. They didn't get to present for these particular light. They couldn't carry the, they couldn't represent this line. I wonder, out of the 600 to 800 people, I wonder if there's 10%, 5%, 1% of salespeople who would qualify, self-qualify because they wanted to, and number two, would be able to learn the new system, and number three, would use the new system. Now, if you were able to identify those people and rather than shotgun your training, rifle shot your training, would that make a difference?
Yeah, probably would. Yes, if we could identify who those people were and get the follow through. That would probably make sense, yes.
Could you see, I'm just dreaming right now, but could you see, I would assume that you're able to communicate with through the distributors to all those 600 to 800 salespeople.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Could you see a campaign like, think of The Biggest Loser or American Idol. Could you see a campaign, 6-week campaign went out saying, this is the program, this is what we're going to be doing. Put your application, see if you qualify. And then take, I don't know, 1%, 10%, whatever it is that you believe you need to have that strike team to meet your numbers, your growth numbers, your aggressive growth numbers. And only take the people who qualify in the top 5, 10%.
I think that's a good idea, though I don't think we should call it the Biggest Loser.
No.
We probably need to come up with a different name than that.
Maybe American Idol, though.
there you go.
Autocrib Idol.
Right. Something other than Biggest Loser. But I think where we struggle is when we go and talk to the CEO of that distributorship, he's not I think one of the things that we've struggled with is these guys are territorial salespeople. In other words, they're based on a geography, and so they own the accounts in a specific geography. Mm-hmm. So when we go and talk to the president that, hey, you know, Joe's worth spending time and effort on, he gets it, but Sam is not. And when we tell the president that we're not going to spend time, energy, money, AutoCrib's time, energy, and money training Sam because he's never going to be a salesperson who gets the approach that we're trying to teach, and so you're just not going to sell vending machines in East Cincinnati. West Cincinnati, we will. And that's a thing we get a lot of pushback on, and he's not willing to accept that. If he truly believes in the vending concept and the integrated supply concept, he wants all of his salesmen to be successful, and he wants us to spend time, money, and energy on all of his salespeople. He doesn't want to give up half of his market. So that's something that's going to take some finesse to sell at the C level within the distribution base.
Can we take it a step further?
Sure.
We would, I'm speaking for AutoCrib now for a moment, would be willing to train any of your people who qualify. And that means, number one, they're going to want to. They got to convince us that they want to make, not just sell vending machines, you know, the vending concept. They can do that all over the place. And we'll support them. But that they want to make the change to this consultative style selling. We'll give them the CDs. Anybody can have the CDs. But the actual training that we're going to do for them, they got to want to. And number two, we got to be able to see that they can do that. And we've got some tools that we're going to share with you, Mr. Distributor Owner, and we'll show you. And if they show us that they can, then we need to know that they will do it, which means we have to get some participation from you in terms of monitoring their behaviors. Are you willing to do that?
Right. Okay. I follow you.
And getting the business owner, the distributor owner, to buy in, it's you're never going to do less than what you're doing right now. I mean, you've got your CDs, right? You've got the programs that are out there that people can use. But if we could really take that strike team, that group of ninjas who are going to actually make a big difference, distributor and you, and pour some resources into them with an adequate return of investment in terms of time, money, resources for that distributor as well as for you. I mean, just thinking that in the same way that you approach that manufacturer, because if manufacturer, you dig down and the manufacturer does not have pain, which means they don't have a willingness to make a change, no selling system is going to get your vending machines in there, right?
That's true, yes.
All right, so if that salesperson doesn't have pain, which translates into desire, there's no system, no selling system, no training system is going to make a difference.
That's right. So if he's got his nut covered every month, he's making mama happy, and there's enough money to golf on the weekends and buy a six pack. He doesn't see a need to change. That's why I've always been a big proponent of long term debt on salesmen. I encourage buying the big Cadillac or the Mercedes or whatever.
Right. All right. So I mean, identifying those people who, number one, have the desire to change, the pain that drives that desire, and then number two, out of that, and it could be 100% who qualify, but out of that, there's going to be a portion of them who have the ability to make the change. I mean, we call it challenge and growth, that they're willing to respond, they're able to respond to challenge, growth, and change. And so they can learn something different. And there's some people who just cannot. So they would have to be able to do that for you to be willing, and for the distributor to be willing to spend time with them, because if it's just going to be a mutually frustrating experience, nobody wants that.
Right.
Right?
Right, so, exactly.
So come up with some specific criteria for being part of, call it what you want, the ninja, you know, the Auto Crib Ninja program for sales excellence. And you qualify for it by wanting it, being able to convince you that they want it. Number two, being able to demonstrate that from some significant tools that they can do it. And then number three, they demonstrate by their behaviors on a monthly basis, quarterly basis.
Right. Okay.
Then you can begin to measure that, and that becomes self-fulfilling, because as you can take those folks who started off with your benchmark, this is where they started, and you mentioned, you know, they're down to 40 or 50,000 after moving down from 90. If you can begin to demonstrate that these folks, by selling in this way, are moving 50, 60, 70, 80,000 a year, you're going to be attracting more. And now you're going to have some momentum from people who are going to believe that it's possible to change.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If you build a king, if you build a rock star, and he's driving around in the new car, and you know, going on the new boat on the weekends, and things are very good, life is good for him, the other guys will look at him and say, "I want to be like him, so I need to do what he does."
Correct. Correct. And out of that 600 to 800, can you imagine that we would have 50 to 100 who could become the rock stars?
Yeah, that's very possible.
And then now imagine that an email goes out every month to every one of those 800 salespeople talking about the rock stars, what they've done, interviews, video. This is what's going on with them.
Right, you could do that. I don't think that would happen, because the distributor, the CEO, is going to say, "Well, no, we're not going to be broadcasting the fact that we won a big contract. We don't need people knowing how we're doing it." They're very nervous about that. That's the distributor mentality. But you could certainly broadcast it within that organization,
okay,
which is really all we care about, right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, send it to the distributor, because for the distributor, he's got a vested interest in helping his sales team be the best they can possibly be, right?
Right, right. He would like to have five rock stars, not one.
Right. And we know, I mean, tender toes here, I understand, but as a fellow trainer, you know that just drilling it into them, if they don't want to and if they can't, is not going to make it work.
Right, that's right. Well, you won't ever get it into them. They just
helping that
get frustrated and they give up.
Yeah. So helping the distributor to identify those people who want to and who can, and then monitoring their behaviors, and then reporting to their team about the success that's possible. It's going to help his people be the best they can be, and you become in addition to being a support, you know, giving them the weapon to go in and take. Market share because of your tool, because of the auto crib, they also they're beginning to develop the technique, the selling technique that's going to help them move even faster.
That's right. Yep.
Okay. All right. So that's the sales part. I don't want to leave today without you telling us about what you've learned from your marketing guru about how to move from where you were to tell us about this truck.
Okay. I attended a meeting, a seminar, if you will, on marketing, I don't know, probably about 18 months ago, 2 years ago. And there was an individual there by the name of Rick Barrera, And he was giving a talk about a book that he had written called Over Promise, Over Deliver. And I thought that was kind of an interesting title, so my ears perked up. And his strategy was, you know, one of the common business books or business systems out there, whatever you want to call it, marketing approaches is you know, under promise and over deliver. And so his whole approach was is you got to make a lot of noise out there. You got to really change what the current thinking is if you're going to have a big impact. And so I actually ended up hiring him as a consultant. I'm a big fan of consultants. Anytime I can plug an expert into my company for a month or a week, whatever it is, and get something done, that's a good thing. So he came in and started working with us. And one of the things that he asked me was, you know, why is your sales cycle so long? Why does it take so long to sell one of these vending machines? And I explained to him all the reasons and you know, what we have to do and how we have to get it through the plant and all that. And how many people have to sign off on this happening? You have to get purchasing to sign off on it. You have to get quality to sign off on it. You have to get the CFO or the accounting people to sign off on it, the plant manager, and finally the tool crib manager. And he said, well, so that's what takes so long. And I said, yes, that's what takes so long. We have to set up 5-6 meetings because you can never get all these guys in the room at one time. And he said, well, what would get all these guys in the room at the same time? And I said, well, if you could get them all to a demo center, and we have 4 or 5 demo centers around the country, when that happens, when we get everybody to come to the demo center at one time, we dramatically reduce the sales cycle. We can close a deal in 2 or 3 months instead of 18 months. And he said, so we need more demo centers. And I said, yeah, but that's expensive. We have to put all these robots in a room somewhere, and it gets used once a week, and it's very, very expensive. So he said, well, what if we had a mobile showroom? What if we brought a demo center right to the plant? And so I thought, oh, that's a pretty good idea. Why don't we should do that? And so we went to work on building a rolling demo center, a showroom that's built into the back of a trailer with a truck that pulls it around the country, and it's a major pain, but it's highly effective. We now do 20 demos a week, and we have reduced our sales cycle from 18 months to about 4 months. So what things have happened with it that we never intended. Like, for instance, we make an appointment with a relatively low-level guy that's going to bring in 2 or 3 other low-level guys. We pull the thing into the front of the manufacturing plant, and we try to park it right in front of the lobby, so it's right in the way. And invariably, within 30 or 40 minutes of being there, we have top management out in the trailer. They see all the commotion. They see people away from their work cells or work centers, and then they wander out into the parking lot and look inside the trailer, and before you know it, we got them in the trailer, and we're taking them through the whole process. So it's been a huge win for us, and it was something that was really just talked over over lunch one day and said, what if we built a demo center that was on wheels that we could actually take to the customer? And the comments we get back are amazing from the actual end users, which is, wow, this is really innovative. Why don't other companies do this? Why do I have to go to a trade show? Why do I have to go to their office? I don't want to take time away from my work. I want you to bring the thing right to me so I can see it. So it's been very well received.
Well, okay. So tell me what happens when that. How does the truck? The truck just drive up and.
Well, we know
it's
a little bit more.
Happens?
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than that. What we do is we first try to soften the beachhead with an aerial bombing campaign. So we first start sending direct mail pieces, and we make them very lumpy. In other words, we put things inside. We don't send just a regular envelope to the decision makers in the company or the influencers. We actually send a big manila envelope, and we put a little toy, a piece of gum, a pack of gum in it, and we say, chew on this. How would you like to reduce your inventory carrying costs by 30%? How would you like to reduce your spend? And we hit them twice a week for 4 weeks with these direct mail pieces. And then 2 weeks before the truck's going to hit that town, we start hitting them with email and actual phone calls. So we'll hit them twice with email saying, hey, the truck's coming to your town. Just reply to this email, and we'll set up an appointment with you. And then we actually have a telephone salesperson that calls them and actually tries to confirm the appointment. So in a particular town, we might have 100 manufacturing facilities or 100 companies that could potentially buy our system or work with a distributor to get a system placed in there, and we'll walk away with about 20 actual confirmed appointments. So that's the process that we go through, and then once we've got the appointment set up, we roll the truck into the town, and we start making the calls each day, and we average between 3 and 4 calls a day. And then out of those 20 visits, we're closing about somewhere in the neighborhood of around 40% of them turn into actual contracts.
Wow.
So that's a hit rate that is significantly better than anything else that we do. Trade shows,
wow,
websites, you know, direct mail.
Excellent.
Pieces.
That is very creative. Now tell us who was the fellow who did that. Let's give him a real big plug, because it sounds to me like he was very
the guy
effective.
That came up with the idea was Rick Barrera, and he's with Over Promise, Over Deliver. He's written a number of sales books. Collaborative Selling is one of them. Over Promise, Over Deliver. And I just met him at a seminar, and he has really helped our marketing effort. He redesigned our website. He's come up with a number of ideas that have really pushed the company forward.
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, we could go on for another hour, because I know that you've got lots of creativity and lots of things that you're working on. We'll have to have you back again on the show sometime. But
sure.
I just got to tell you, thank you so much. Now, if somebody happened to be in manufacturing out there or in, let's see, you're also working in, did you tell me you're working in medical, delivery of medical supplies?
Right, yeah. We have a new division where we're working in the dental and veterinarian market. We're building vending machines for dentists and veterinarian hospitals, clinics. So we're applying some of the technology that we've used in the industrial world for years to the medical market. We see that as a growth area. That company is called Cubex, and you can find them on the Internet at cubexsystems.com. And then, of course, autocrib.com is our industrial division.
All right. Do you directly, how would they get in touch with you?
You want my email address? Is that what you're asking for, Will?
However you want.
Probably the best way is via email. I do travel a lot, so that would be spixley, P-I-X, like x-ray, L-E-Y, at autocrib.com.
Great. Is there anything else you'd like to tell the audience, Steve?
I think that probably the one thing that, from a sales standpoint, is that you got to really try a lot of different things. I mean, we don't, when we try something new and we spend money, it's always frustrating when something fails. But you got to continue to try new things and work at things until you find something that works. And then once you do find something that works, you got to really exploit it and drive it home. So that's been my experience as a CEO, and that's worked pretty well for me.
Thank you so much for taking your time to be with us today. You've given our audience a lot to think about, and
we
look forward to
me.
Talking to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you. There you have it. Steve Pixley from his garage to changing the whole industry of how you distribute, account for, monitor, and sell tools into industry in America. And soon distribute drugs and medical supplies into various places where people need them. These are the kind of things that are out there in Orange County. And this pilgrim is looking all around and finding all sorts of interesting people and places and things to talk about. I invite you to nominate a friend or a fellow that you see who would be interested and interesting to talk to other business owners and CEOs in Orange County about what's going on in their business. You can get me at willcrist@willcrist.com, W-I-L-L-C-R-I-S-T at at wilchrist.com. You can call me at 949-355-6013. That's 949-355-6013. The Pilgrim on the 405 is looking for people to talk about their business and share some of their innovation and creativity and enthusiasm for this economy, which everybody tells me is beginning to make the slow change. It may not happen tomorrow or the next day, but we're on our way to a thriving economy in Orange County. So that's it for today. This is the Pilgrim on the 405. Looking forward to talking to you again next week.
You've been listening to the one and only Will Crist as he discovers the new techniques and new technologies making people succeed today through his pilgrimage up and down the 405, only on octalkradio.net.